Hello, welcome again to Comic Connoisseurs. Tonight we'll be talking about Black Panther, the latest Marvel movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Of course, I'm my co-host, JT from Saskatoon.
I didn't freeze.
Also with us is Red Ink.
I don't know the way.
As I said, we were talking about Black Panther, the latest movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Previous episode, we talked about, you know, a lot of the drama about the reviews and you know, people saying if you rate less than 100, you're a racist. People, you know, conspiracy theories that have proven to be false, of an alt-right conspiracy to give it a lower review, even though, like I said, it's been proven false. The review score has gone down slightly, but again, honestly, I consider the movie overall like an 80 at best, 80, 85 at best.
It's a B+.
And it was not an A minus. It was definitely lower than
that. No, I was gonna say an A minus looks better on your report card than a B+.
That's true. Overall, the movie just had problems. Was it entertaining though? Yes. Yes, it was entertaining. Did it suffer certain problems with it? Yes, it did. And I think it's time to talk about these things. First of all, JT, your overall impressions of the movie. We're not going to go into the minutiae, and we'll try to avoid the minutiae in every spot. We just want to talk about broad strokes. How did you feel about the movie?
I loved it. You know, it's definitely, like I said, it's an A- B+. It's probably one of the best Marvel films since the original Iron Man. You know, it's just a good, solid comic book film. You know, I like how they explain the origin of Wakanda in that opening scene. You know, we get some prehistory to the main thing. You know, the film itself takes place, they say, about a week after the events of Captain America Civil War, and T'Challa is about to be crowned King of Wakanda. It's got elements from all over the Panther lore, from like the original Jack Kirby and Lee stories to the Chris Priest series to, you know, elements here and there of the Reginald Hudlin wrote the Romita Jr. arc, right?
Yeah.
Where they have like a bunch of superheroes invade Wakanda. I mean, overall, I like the movie. It's perfectly all right. There are some things that I kind of question, both in the film and the other things that a lot of other people seem to be obsessing about for some reason. But overall, I enjoyed the hell out of it. Red?
Red has not seen the movie yet.
I know, I just wanted to have him as part of the conversation.
I haven't seen the movie. I don't know what the fuck to say about it. I can talk about the controversy surrounding it. I know about that, and I think it's all bullshit.
Because God forbid somebody should see something. And then we talked about in that last episode where we talked about how everyone's losing their ever-loving minds. It's just, judge not the book by its cover, people. Like, watch the movie, then form your opinion of it.
It's not just that. It's also been proven to be fake news. Like,
well,
people saying, oh, I've been attacked when I went to see the Black Panther.
Yeah.
Some black people jump me. Then they show a picture of, like, fucking some actor people barely know about, beat up in a movie, and it's like, this is me. I got beat up.
Yeah, yeah. There's lots of false narratives on both sides of this movie, and I think that's sort of silly. I mean, this is not a hill to die on, is what I think. Black Panther is not a hill to die on. I think people who picked it as their hill to die on are stupid and really should have exercised some more caution than they did. The action scenes were fun. The one thing I had to point out, though, is the attempts to appeal to an Asian audience with the Marvel films is getting a little out of control here. I mean, we in the end of Doctor Strange, the final act takes place in Hong Kong. Age of Ultron, you have the middle act take place in Seoul, Korea, And by the way, Seoul is never that free of traffic jams. I don't know what they did to have the roads that clear in Seoul, but it's never, the traffic never flows that quickly. And now you have Black Panther, where you have the second act in Busan, Korea. It's at this point this meetup to catch Claw, which is why they went to Busan, could have been anywhere. It could have been at some imaginary casino in Italy. It could have been in Las Vegas. It could have been anywhere. They picked Busan as a way to pander to an Asian audience, and I felt it. And like I said, Age of Ultron, I was like, okay, because they introduced the Korean scientist earlier, I get it. What's it called? Doctor Strange. Yeah, they have to have different geographic locations for the sanctuaries. Okay, soft pass. But now it's like, okay, stop pandering. Or at least try to put some more effort into making it more natural.
That's fair. I mean, I would have argued.
By the way, the Korean lady that was selling the squid looked almost exactly like my aunt.
Well, you should have been all for it, Ben. I don't know. The setting the lab in Avengers in, you know, Seoul. Okay, sure.
What does that even mean? This boy should be all for. And they make it sound like he wants to fuck his aunt.
I said he should have. Hey, that kind of looks like my aunt. That's cool, you know. That's what I meant by all four. It was like, hey, that actress kind of looks like, you know, I've got a cousin who looks like Alex Winter from Bill and Ted. I've just kind of always enjoyed that, you know, the comparison, but that's really as far as it goes. No, I mean, I get Seoul and Ultron, you know, you get Hong Kong with the, you know, with the sanctuary. Strange. That's what I meant. Like having the sanctum there. I mean, from what I've read over the years and like other comics and other books I've read throughout my life, you know, you learn about Eastern, like Chinese mysticism and how London has like this rich history of the occult and various mystical practices coming together there in a lot of ways. I mean, it's cool. It made sense to have the sanctums there. Aside from, now, the only reason I think they would have put the whole exchange thing in Korea, you know, like you said, Ben, that they may have been trying to appeal to the, you know, the Asian people. Sure, I don't think it's really pandering, mind you. But in an interview, Ryan Coogler, who's the director, made reference to the fact that, you know, he's a huge fan of like old school Bond and a big fan of the Daniel Craig Bond. So I think they're trying to get that whole kind of heist, you know, action, kind of that Bond flavor from the whole casino sequence. That's where I see that coming from, really. I mean, but who knows what their, until you talk to the guys, you couldn't say what their exact intentions were.
Well, again, you know, the Bond thing actually in itself is a bit of a tell, because again, a lot of the older Bond films take place in, like I said, casinos in Italy, Spain, or even Las Vegas. I mean, Diamonds Are Forever, Dr. No, From Russia With Love. I mean, these are movies where there are casino set pieces, and they are not in Korea.
True, and just, they, for whatever reason, they put it in Korea. But, I mean, aside from that, I like how...
What's wrong with it being in Korea?
It's, like I said, we have... I named three instances of three movies.
I know you named three instances of three movies of where they set these movies in Asian buildings, but what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is in the first two instances, they felt somewhat natural. In this instance, it felt very tacked on. The location could have been anywhere.
So if they put it in Johannesburg, South Africa, would that have made more sense?
I wouldn't have been against it, no. It wouldn't have felt as obvious to, like I said, one of the strategies of movies nowadays is to appeal to the Asian audience, because the Asian audience is a big draw with after the U.S. release of films, there's the international release, and the Asian audience is usually as big, if not bigger, than the American release if all things go well.
I mean, that's fair, but I think you're reading into it a little too much.
That's
but
fair. I could be. I mean, I admit I could be reading more into this than it is there. But again, I just want to say, you know, just pay attention to the next year. See how many movies, large movies, have set pieces placed in Asia, and just see how natural it feels most of the time. And that's all I ask.
True. I mean, it's not like your argument doesn't have anything, but I mean, we should just quick recap of the plot. Like I said, it's a week after Civil War. T'Challa assumes the throne, finally finds where Klaw is after the events of Ultron. He goes to intercept him. Turns out Klaw is working with Eric Stevens, who is really, you know, has the code name Killmonger because he's like a black ops soldier after growing up and entering the military in the U.S., Killmonger claims right of challenge to the throne because it turns out he is the cousin to T'Challa. And for a while we think T'Challa has died. Turns out he was rescued by the Jabari tribe, who's led by a man named M'Baku, who for people that have complained about, you know, racist characters in comics, I really can't argue against this. He's known as the Man-Ape in the comics, and he wears the skin of a white gorilla. He doesn't do that in the film. He is more, I'd say M'Baku is a lot more similar to Jason Momoa's Aquaman. He's definitely got this kind of, you know, dude bro, little bit of that swagger going on. But by the end of it, T'Challa is rescued by them. He is healed. He comes back to, you know, I didn't quit, you know, which is in that scene. And possibly also because Michael B. Jordan is playing Killmonger, when he said, I did not quit, is kind of like from Rocky V, where Rocky's like, hey, Tommy, I didn't hear no bell. You know, I really love that. By the end of it, Killmonger has been defeated. T'Challa decides to break the isolationist policies that have ruled this country since time immemorial and, you know, proposes to introduce Wakanda to the world.
So one thing I have to say is M'Baku as a character in this movie was actually a fun character. He was elegant, hilarious. He came off as a ruler, as you know, maybe not as eloquent as T'Challa, but definitely a ruler in his own right. A ruler that T'Challa respected enough that when they were fighting in combat for the right of the throne of Wakanda, you know, T'Challa even says, you know, I, not so much the words "I need you," but the words that, you know, for his people, he needs to yield, and M'Baku actually pays this mercy back later. And like I said, the character came off great. The character M'Baku came off great. Not as a, he wasn't a villain in this movie, but he was definitely a semi anti-hero until he went full hero at the end. And again, it's my favorite part is Ross, CIA agent Ross, tries to talk in his audience, and he tells them to be silenced, or feed Ross to his children. And there's a silence until he laughs a hearty laugh and says, "I'm kidding, we're vegetarians."
Yeah,
and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I'm gonna ask you, Red. Are you familiar with Man-Ape from the comics?
Somewhat familiar, a little.
Yeah, it's.
He's a D-lister, honestly.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you've seen, like, Earth's Mightiest Heroes, you know, you've seen him in the episode that introduced the Black Panther. You know, he's not quite that big. The actor, Winston Duke, the dude is fairly big. Like, he definitely has that presence that you want from somebody. Like, okay, I could see this guy being an actual gorilla that's not a racial con. I'm just saying this guy has got some mass to him. I'd say another character, finally to see her in a Marvel movie. I've said for years, like ever since I was a kid, because I had a big ass crush on Angela Bassett. I almost said Vanessa Williams. Angela Bassett, I've said since I was like 12 that she should be Storm. We didn't get Storm, but we finally got her in a Marvel movie, and I thought she did very well in her scenes as Ramonda, you know, Queen Mother of Wakanda. You had Letitia Wright as Shuri, T'Challa's sister. One of the best characters, I think, was introduced in the Reginald Hudlin series. I like her. She was the cue to T'Challa's bond. You know, she was sassy. She had a sense of humor. She had a lot of fun. I still love the comment where they bring at one scene where they've captured Klaue, and then Killmonger breaks him out, and Ross takes a bullet meant for Nakia, who's T'Challa's ex, basically. She's like a spy working for the Wakandan government. They bring Ross back to Wakanda to the Great Mount, to Shuri's lab, to heal him. And she's like, oh, great, another white boy for me to fix. Which, like, spoiler alert, obviously, the end credit scene involves, we see Bucky has been released from the deep freeze. Presumably the brainwashing has been excised from his mind. And there are these Wakandan children who, in their language, refer to him as the White Wolf. Now, the White Wolf is a character from Black Panther lore who is a white man who kind of had like a Tarzan-esque origin, where his family crashes in Wakanda, and then T'Chaka adopts him as his ward because he feels sorry for the kid's situation. Eventually, he's called the White Wolf, and he's like the head of the Wakandan secret police. Now, the kids might just be calling Bucky that, and maybe he'll go on to become, after Infinity War, he'll become like the Wakandan CIA, or maybe they're just referring to him as that because there's this other white guy living in the country. We don't know for sure yet.
Let's avoid, like I said, breaking the movie down piece by piece.
I know, I'm just saying that for that example of Black Panther lore, you know, but I love that line, and I love that scene where you'll know it when you see it, Red, but there's a scene where, you know, T'Challa goes and we see his suit from Civil War, then we see the new, from the current Black Panther comic, all the stuff is in this necklace that he wears around, and, you know, it's kind of almost like a techno symbiote sort of thing, just spreads out over his body. You see Shuri having some fun at T'Challa's expense when he gets taken for a ride while testing this new suit. I can't wait for you to see this, Red, because it'd be a lot. You know, we might have to come back to this. I know. What did you think of the lab scene, Ben?
I enjoyed it. I mean, obviously, this was one of these scenes played for levity, but also to introduce us to the suit and set up the Chekhov's gun of the gold necklace for later use. And one thing I have to mention is, we have to definitely mention Forrest Whitaker as Zuri, almost like a shaman character, and Forrest Whitaker did a fantastic job of it. Go ahead.
Forrest Whitaker as a shaman? I don't think so.
What was amazing to me was the fact that they had scenes in 1993 where they found a young black actor to play a young Forrest Whitaker, and they made sure he had the same lazy eye.
You know what the cool, even something cooler about that, Ben?
What?
That actor's name is Denzel Whitaker. No relation.
Just he has the same damn lazy eye.
Yeah. I'd have to go back and look at Civil War, because when T'Challa, after he beats the Rite of Passage, you know, he makes M'Baku tap, and he goes and he's already taken the heart-shaped herb, which is something from Black Panther comic, folks, that gives him his abilities. It's an herb that's native to Africa, or to Wakanda, and has been, pardon me, enhanced by the enhanced by the vibranium. And it's neutralized during the challenge, then he takes it again afterwards, and they bury him in this, like, red sand, and he goes to, like, the astral plane to commune with the former Black Panther spirits. He talks to his dad. Now, John Connie, who played T'Chaka in Civil War and reprises the role here, I don't know if that was a CGI effect or he actually has, like, a super lazy eye and we just didn't notice it before, but when you see him in the astral plane, you see, like, his left eye, Like, if you thought Forrest Whitaker had lazy eye, no, this it is positively, like...
He has a like, coma eye.
Yeah, he's got, like, this MC Dali sort of droop to it. I think that was just a put-on for being in the astral plane and all that. But no, I'd like to see him back, and I love... Even that brief scene we got with him in Civil War and where you get him here, that really got to me because, you know, I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this before, but, you know, I lost my dad about 10 years ago to a heart attack. You know, anything I've seen since then involving a father and son, it just really gets to me. And it's just to see that look in Chadwick Boseman's eyes where they shoot that scene. That was a really powerful scene for me. I really loved that scene.
Well,
the one character I thought was going to last longer than he did was Ulysses Klaue, you know, Andy Serkis.
I feel like they blew their load early on him. They didn't know where they were going to go with him. And the character goes from a competent villain to...
Gollum.
So not just Gollum. He is a comedy act. I mean, there's a car chase scene... And he tells his henchmen to turn the radio on. This isn't the funeral. Turn the radio on. He wants to hear some tunes, damn it. And I apologize, but I know what they're trying to do. It just didn't work with this character.
Yeah, because you see him in, you know, Age of Ultron. And did you like Klaue in Age of Ultron, Red?
It's all right.
Yeah. I like that whole bit where he's talking to Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, and he's talking about the cuttlefish and, you know, just that whole thing. Like, it's like you get this sense of sinister foreboding from him because is he just like trying to set them up, or is he just mentally insane or something? And in this one, they turned him into a goddamn cartoon. I mean, he was practically like Monterey Jack in Rescue Rangers when he's sniffing that, piece of vibranium they steal from the London Museum, and then you think he's going to come with Killmonger to Wakanda, and then, you know, he's killed in a shootout. Now, and this is just me, I would have added a third end credit scene. Like, you have the first one after, like, the fancy credits before you get into the rigmarole. Halfway through that, you would have had, I would have put the UN scene, and at the end credit scene, I mean, now that they've got the rights back to the Fantastic Four, and that's where Klaue originally premiered, you could have had something where he breathes and you hear this weird, noticeably, like, digitized sound come out of him. Like, maybe he had a piece of vibranium on him, and he's going to somehow turn into the man of sound that he is in the comics. I mean, they could have certainly done that. That's, you know, again, that's wishful thinking on my part, but I would have loved if they had done something like that. I mean, not to say they couldn't bring him back in some BS role later on, because it's comics and movies. If you can think of a halfway logical way to resurrect somebody, why not? I mean, for years, Bucky was deader than dead. He was Uncle Ben dead, and in the comics, they've even found ways to bring Uncle Ben or a version thereof back a time or two.
But the important thing I think we need to focus on is let's talk now about where the movie goes and specifically my problems with it. So the main message of the movie is early on in the movie they have a flashback in 1993 where T'Chaka's brother is sent as a spy in the United States. And as he is in the United States, he decides that he is starting to smuggle Wakandan weapons to the streets of the United States to help with fighting the street wars because so many black people are in jail and stuff. It's super vague, and the idea is basically that.
When does he go back?
1993.
That's a little late. You should have went to the 80s. And, like when, during the Ronald Reagan mission, when he militarized the police. That would be the most... most impact.
But the problem I have with this is this concept, this message that that basically Wakanda should basically take care of and help all black people around the world that struggle. And the honest truth is that sort of ethnic tribalism really doesn't exist. And the way they portray it is very unrealistic. I mean the great example of this is the fact that if you go to Africa, and you know, just from the territorial borders there, you know, people, you know, it's just like anywhere else in the world. People have problems and despise each other, you know, if you go 1 mile over a border. It's just like everywhere else. And the idea that these people should be, you know, should come together just because they're black it's a nice fantasy, but it rings very hollow and disingenuous. And let me give you an example of a scene I think that best states how this feels for me. Has anyone seen the original movie In the Heat of the Night?
Not for many years, but I have seen it.
Great movie. Everyone should watch it. Sidney Poitier, one of his best roles as Virgil Tibbs. So the basic rundown of the premise of In the Heat of the Night is in a small town in Mississippi, a black homicide detective from Philadelphia is passing through in the middle of the night, and he gets picked up under suspicion of murdering someone in the street. It very quickly turns out that he is a homicide detective, and basically then the baffled small town police sheriff pretty much has to beg Detective Tibbs' help for solving this crime because his small town police department isn't equipped with the expertise to handle this sort of murder investigation. And one of the most striking things to me in this movie is a scene at the train depot where Virgil is waiting for his train so he can just get out of there. And the sheriff comes up to him and is basically explaining why they need this investigation, why they need to find this murderer. Basically, he says, we can't build this factory in town until we find the murderer. And this factory will bring in 1,000 jobs. Half of them will be colored. And the sheriff says, these are your people. And Virgil turns up and says, no, they're yours. You made this scene. And I thought that was a very poignant moment for me because to Virgil, it's not about them being black. It's no, they're from Mississippi. He's not from Mississippi. He lives in Philadelphia. You know, putting him in that scene is, you know, it's he doesn't live there, and at the end of the day, he gets to leave.
I get you. So. You know, some of the elements of, you know, the, like, Killmonger's plot, like, in the comic book, he is, as in this movie, like, he is as smart, if not just slightly smarter than T'Challa. You know, he's a little more cunning, you know, he doesn't have the moral, you know, qualms that T'Challa might have in a situation. But, I mean, Killmonger's origin is like he finds his dad's body after he's essentially been, well, I wouldn't say murdered, but he's been killed by T'Chaka, who, you know, then he just kind of, you know, GTFOs and goes back to Wakanda, because when T'Challa goes to talk to him, he's like, I couldn't have him around, be a threat to the throne. It's like, at the very least, asshole. You could have taken your nephew in. I mean, you could have lied to him for his entire life and told him that somebody else killed your dad. You know, it's like, you know, T'Chaka's not blameless. No one's perfect in this movie. And then that event, you know, kind of radicalizes Eric, who goes on to become like this kill crazy Black Ops soldier who gets the code name Killmonger. And, you know, like I said, he's of royal blood, so, you know, he can challenge for the throne after the fact. You know, I like that. And his whole plan is to take over Wakanda and then send this technology out into the world and cause a revolution. You know, and then I forget the name of T'Challa's friend who gets, like, really down on him for not... For not taking out Claw. Yeah, where T'Challa did this one time, and then the guy's just like, well, screw you. Your dad didn't do it. Why should I expect anything from you? And, you know, he totally switches sides when, you know.
And T'Challa could have solved that easily by saying, hey, you know how I didn't catch that guy? It's because that guy you're standing next to right there broke him out right when I was about to take him in.
Well, he didn't know that, you know, at the time. But that's the sort of thing, like, would he have really been listening to T'Challa? It's like, you did nothing for me. He did everything for me, you know, that sort of thing. And the character's name, just looking at the wiki here, Wakabi, he's the head of security for the border tribe, which basically they're the first line of defense for invaders from outside Wakanda. And, I mean, it was a pretty smooth part on Killmonger because he walks right up to this guy, drops the guy, the body of the man who killed his parents at his face, says, I gotta get into the city. He's like, right this way, sir. And then you have that scene at the end where the border tribe goes to war against the Dora Milaje, which are the, you know, the Wakandan royal guard, you know, all females, all butt kickers. What's the name of the lead?
I feel like, you know, We should avoid the play by play. But the one thing I do have to say with these scenes is, you know, so much of these problems could have been solved with diplomacy. Not to mention the fact that, you know, Wakanda is the way Wakanda is because of their years and years of following strict adhere tradition. The only reason Killmonger even briefly had the throne was because they adhere to tradition. And the second he got the throne, the first thing he did was say, fuck tradition, I'm going to do whatever the hell I want. And that should have, like, made everyone go, wait a minute, what? Because when he had them burn down the garden of the fruits for the Black Panther, and then when they point out, hey, wait, T'Challa's still alive, the challenge combat has not been finished because he didn't die and he didn't yield, and they said, okay, the fight hasn't finished, you're not king anymore, you know, the first thing Killmonger says is, oh, I'm through with this fool, kill him. And it's like, but people be like, but the reason you even had a chance to become king, or even briefly become king, was because we followed tradition. And now, just because tradition isn't working for you at this very moment, you want to go against it?
Excuse me, sir. Sir. In Itchy and Scratchy, episode 17.
Okay. I got it.
He strikes the same rib 3 times, producing 3 different sounds. Was somebody fired for this mistake?
So what Ben was talking about there, about the whole strict adherence to tradition and the whole isolationist policies, one thing I would toss back to you, Ben, is, you know, talking about how they had these extreme tribalistic designs and how, you know, like the guy with the lip disc and all that. Well, why would they not have, my question is, why would they not have that sort of design aesthetic still? I mean, they don't really accept outside influences. They've kept everything within their borders to a great extent, so probably why they still are dressing like that. But again, not my culture, I couldn't say for sure. Now, the as far as the whole tradition thing, it's like they have that great scene in the throne room between Nakia and Okoye, who is played by Danai Gurira. You know her as Michonne on the Walking Dead TV show. And she's like, no, you take the Queen Mother and Shuri and, you know, GTFO, I have to stay. And she's like, no, come with me. No, I have to stay. I've sworn an oath to, you know, serve the throne, serve the king. Like, she's kind of damned if she does and damned if she don't. And that's a great little moment of drama, because you get this, like, I want to go. I do not agree with what's happening, but it's her lot in life to protect the king. And unfortunately, this asshole who literally just walked in the door is now the king.
Walked in and is acting almost exactly like the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Oh, pretty much. But, I mean, that was the great thing. And then that's why she was so quick to turn on Killmonger when T'Challa comes back. Is like, I done. And she's like, challenge isn't over. He's still alive. And it's not like they were really going to go back to the waterfall ceremonial area and, like, take the neutralizing drug again. I mean, now they're on even terms. You know, T'Challa is, like, he's healed up. He's whole. He's got his suit. And, you know, as you talked about the gold necklace earlier, from what I've read, the design of that necklace and the overall panther suit is a direct callback to the design of the panther, to the what's called in the comics the panther habit, because essentially he's a president, king, and pope of Wakanda, T'Challa is. The design of that costume comes directly from the Chris Priest Black Panther run in the late 90s, you know, which... And you get into that whole thing where, you know, it's taken some time. He's got, like, some new dreads going on. He's looking all pimp and all that. And he's like, yeah, we're going to take over the world. And he's not even going to, like you said, he's not even going to bother with T'Challa. He's like, kill this fool. He walks away. And then Okoye's like, that's your shit. Handle it. And then the Dora Milaje go to war with the border tribe. Now, you know, you talk about that last fight. It's great. It looks like the Dora Milaje are about to get worked. And then, you know, M'Baku and his tribe come running over the hill. And they have this great thing where they come to the first challenge scene in the beginning of the film. And when, you know, Ross is talking, when they're just coming up to the, you see, like, this big stone gargoyle, gorilla face in the cliffside, which is, like, the entrance to their territory. And they're just like, oh. And they're barking like that or grunting, and you just see them come, and it's just like, okay, let's go to war. And it's like you said earlier, he's got this sense of honor. You know, T'Challa came to him as an equal and respected him. It's like, I need your help on this. And he's like, no, we're not going to fight for you. Okay, would you mind looking after my moms? And he's like, I can do that. And it proves he's an anti-hero at best and a king most of all. Like, he is a king of his people. It was a great scene that, you know, I've seen one review, and this guy is like, if I'm a Black Panther fan, this guy is Derek something. I read a friend of mine posted, he's like, you want to see a fanboy review of the movie? He likened the, was it the Dabari tribe? Dabar or M'Baku, when they come over the hill like that, he likened it to Gandalf coming over the hill in the Two Towers. And that's when I just turned that article off and I walked away, because clearly that man has taken leave of reality. It was a really cool scene. It's just, it's
when
not
you described that it, that's what I saw.
I think they were kind of going for that, but the way this guy talked about it, like, this is like the most epic thing in the entire movie. I was like, it's cool. It's really cool. It's not that cool. I would say the more epic scene in the movie was, you know, Killmonger's trying to send this gear out of Wakanda, and Ross gets into this virtual reality cockpit for T'Challa's craft in the movie, and, you know, he goes Top Gun on him. And for a while there, would you say that those smaller attack ships kind of look like dragonflies, Ben?
They did look a little bit like dragonflies.
Yeah, one of these dragonfly ships is like blasting at the window to Shuri's lab, where Ross is like using the VR chair, and the way it's like the glass integrity at 80%, and then you just get this look in his face, is like, how long do I have? Like, I thought for sure they were gonna like sacrifice Ross or something, and I mean, I'm glad they didn't, because Evercare Ross is a pretty cool character in the comics. I'd like to see him come back for the sequel, and it was an awesome scene. Now, I mean, we've prattled on and on. Do you, Red, have any questions in regards to the movie that Ben and I could answer for you?
Not really, no.
All right, well, one thing I have to say is the whole message about, you know, that they tried to paint about black culture and all that, and how, you know, they're downtrodden, but they need all they need is to be lifted up. It sort of shits the bed when at the end of the scene you have this scene where T'Challa reveals his hover ship and has it parked right next to the, you know, in Southern California, in this black neighborhood, and you have all these black kids, like none of them are older than 12, start crowding around it, going, "Whoa, it's a spaceship!" And then one of them says, "Hey, let's take it apart and sell the parts on eBay."
I don't think that's a commentary on black culture so much as that's how you gotta hustle
really,
nowadays. Let it go, Ben. Let it go.
Well, let me say this. From what I've heard of this movie and how it's supposed to have, like, a message, and it's an all-black movie, blah, blah, all that shit, ending it off with, "Let's steal its fucking shit," kind of ruins the whole fucking message.
Thank you.
I don't know if it ruins undercuts.
Think of it this way. It's like a punch bowl. A nice punch bowl. It's crystal. It's red. Like, the punch is nice and red. It's lit up nice. Has ice in it. Then somebody takes a big steaming fucking dump in the middle of it. That's what that sounds like to me.
The message was supposed to be this hopeful message of, you know, we can teach the next generation and have them succeed where the past generations failed. Red's right. It takes a dump in the punch bowl when you have these kids, these young hopeful kids, you know, looking up to Black Panther, looking up to a ship, being like, "Wow, cool, Wakanda Tech is cool," to you know, "Let's steal the ribs."
They wouldn't have said "cool Wakanda tech" because, I mean, they didn't know about Wakanda at that point.
Now, you can have that scene in the movie. There's be nothing wrong with it. But bookending the fucking movie with that scene was a dumb fucking decision.
Yes, it was. Let's steal the rims.
Okay, I think you're concentrating the wrong aspect of that scene, guys. Because, again, I saw an interview with Coogler on, I think it was with Nerdist on YouTube, and he's talking the reason that one of the end scenes, he didn't specify that was the last scene in the film proper, but the reason he had that as the last scene is it kind of is in bookend to the original scene we see where, you know, T'Challa's dad kills his brother, and that's that apartment building. That's where T'Challa is going to build this, like, Wakandan outreach center. You know, Nakia and Shuri are going to be based there, and it's going to be this whole cultural exchange program that he's got going on. And he's like just trying to deal with it. He's trying to make something good out of something bad. I personally would have liked to have that scene. I would have made that the mid-credit scene and then put the UN scene at the end like that. Because I thought it would have been a great, better way to end the movie with, like, this, you know, shave, no hair, glasses. "I'm sorry, King T'Challa, but what can a nation of farmers offer the world?" And you just see, like, T'Challa and Ross exchange this little smiles like, "Oh, bitch, you didn't." You know, I would have preferred that. Now, I'm going to ask you, Ben. Like I said, I would have added an end credit scene, you know, having Ulysses Klaue start, you know, hint at the transformation into the Man of Sound. Is there any other sort of bit of, like, Black Panther lore or something that you would have maybe added in a scene or some sort of a reference?
Not really. I think the movie did what it could with what it had, and didn't try to add too much visual Easter eggs or I know that stuff. I think it had a good level of restraint in that form, and I enjoyed what they did add. At the level of what they added it to. But
One other thing, like how you talked about the message of, like, you know, like they have the whole, you know, "We're going to radicalize," or not radical, "We're going to arm everyone. There's going to be this revolution of our oppressors." I mean, that's one of the more politically minded aspects of the film that it didn't quite make sense to me, but it's part of a larger piece of the narrative, which was the question, you know, where T'Challa questions very early in the film, before he's even taken the rite of passage, is, why don't we do more? Like, why don't we share what we have, you know? And other people, well, if we do that, then the outside world's going to get in, and then they're going to want everything. And then again, I got to look up his name. Wakabi says, well, if we start bringing in refugees, you know what the refugees bring with them? They bring their problems. And that was a line that I was like, gee, that's not a commentary in the current political climate in our society now, is it?
That is actually very true, though. I mean, with immigration, you know, I'm not even going to go there. I just want to say,
yeah, don't. I don't go too deep into it.
I don't want to go there. And in fact, you know what? I think this is a good spot to stop for now. When Red sees the movie, if he sees the movie, we will revisit this in a later show. I think this is getting to the point where, I mean,
I wanted to say one thing.
Yes, go ahead, Red.
Said I wanted to add on to JT's ending with Claw.
Yeah.
Except for JT went on for like 20 minutes.
Well, I have to do something. You haven't contributed a whole lot today, but please continue.
I know I haven't contributed. I would end it with Claw in prison and them discussing something about his powers going out of control and fucking how do we contain it. Then you see, like, Andrew Lincoln come out of the shadows with a fucking skunk stripe on his head and saying, I got some thoughts on that.
That would have been cool. All right, so this is a good spot where we can like wrap up. Okay, now.
One thing, Ben.
Okay,
I want to ask you, what would you like to see in the sequel? Because they have pretty much all but guaranteed there's going to be a sequel at this point. I mean, what would you like to see in the sequel?
I don't know. It's Black Panther was never a big top 10 favorite of mine, so I don't have expectations of what they put in. So honestly, I don't know.
Okay.
Storm.
Sorry, Red?
Storm.
You know what? Who knows when the sequel will happen, then that could certainly be a thing. I would like to... I got to look up, make sure I get the original Hudlin. That's Hudlin, right?
Yes. So,
the beginning of Volume 4, the initial six issues, what featured this consortium of villains led by Claw... to basically invade and attempt to depose T'Challa. And while certainly they couldn't follow that to the letter, I mean, if they come up with a way to alter that for the MCU, I would love to see that as being the plot of the next Black Panther movie. I think that would be a hell of a thing. Again, you could keep it pretty much contained to Wakanda. And, you know, if we think they're badass now, let's see what happens when Wakandans go to war, because I'm pretty sure somebody's going to get worked.
I think we're going to see Wakanda go to war in Infinity War. We already saw all the footage pretty much painting that already. But let's wrap this up. Overall, like I said, Black Panther, not a bad movie. I gave it an 80%, worth watching. But it's not going to wow your feet. It's definitely no Iron Man. Definitely no Civil War. But not bad. JT?
Like I said before, I would liken this to the original Iron Man in terms of quality and... I really like the movie. It's an A-, a B+. You know, it's not perfect, but darn near.
All right, and Red has yet to see it, but let's wrap this up. This is your host, Ben.
JT from Saskatoon.
Ready.
We're saying goodnight.
So long.
Peace out.